Welcome to What We Left Behind, a discussion on Season 4. I'm John Streeter.
And I'm Joe Parker.
Let's get started.
Well, John, here we are at the end of Season 4.
It's been a long road.
It has been.
Getting from there to here.
When I think about the first episode, it seems like it was years ago.
It does. Yeah, it's like crazy. 2020 was the time warp year where it felt like we're in March forever. This has been a time warp season.
Yeah, it sure has.
And yet it's funny because at school, it feels like the school year started like 3 weeks ago.
Wow.
Yeah.
Why?
I don't know. But this school year has flown by.
Huh.
Probably because I love this year's senior class and I've not been wanting them to graduate. And of course, that means that my brain says, okay, we're going to speed through this year.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So what are we doing today, Joe?
So in accordance with the end of the season, we're going to ask each other questions that we either forgot to ask or ran out of time, or things that we wanted to ask that we weren't really sure about.
Okay.
So,
all right. Yeah, I think this will be a nice change of pace from the last couple episodes of the season that were pretty heavy. I mean, a lot of this season has been heavy, but especially the commentary, the brilliant commentary that you wrote about Auschwitz last week.
Oh.
This is a good way to
try and lighten it up a little bit.
Yeah, lighten it up, lift everyone's spirits at the end of this season.
Absolutely.
But this is not the end of 15-minute history, by no means. Those of you who have been with us for a couple of years know that we operate kind of on a season schedule like a TV show. We will be back this fall. We'll talk more about that at the end of the discussion.
But absolutely.
Let's dive right in. And since you wrote the opener, Joe, I'm going to ask you the first question.
Uh-oh, here we go.
Yeah. So this being a time for history, and that being one of the themes of this season, I'm curious, is there a period of history that as you learned more about, you, one, learned from history and your opinions changed, and two, that you didn't learn from history and it cost you something, not in terms of like a physical or financial cost or something like that, but you now realize, boy, I wish I had listened or I'd understood the lessons of history, you know, a little bit sooner?
Great question. So to answer the first part of your question, I would say I'm always learning. Mm-hmm. There's always something new that I hadn't thought about before, a new person, a new circumstance, a new context that I wasn't previously aware of.
Mm-hmm.
So I try to not look through the lens of the modern day when I read about historical people, events, or places. And with that comes a lot of freedom and opportunity to learn more and mm-hmm. gain a better understanding that I can then apply to life in general.
Okay, but there's not one specific... I mean, that's a good answer, so I'm not
yeah.
trying to say, you know,
I'm trying to
give
think
me more detail. I mean, because like when we were doing the Civil War discussion, I think I blew your mind a little bit when talking about the founding fathers and their perspectives on slavery and
yeah,
and like
I think that's
that
an example.
An
yeah,
example.
Sure. I think that I was aware of that to a certain extent.
Yeah.
But having that reinforced during our discussion and also knowing that not all the founding fathers were that way, it would be really, really easy to group them all together and say, oh my gosh, we've been cursed since the beginning.
Yeah.
But it is important. It was a reminder to me in those moments to look at history as it was, not what I would like it to be. And so again, while the founding fathers were brilliant and they created a system like that, they created something new
mm-hmm.
that allowed the injustices that came with that to be corrected, it was still a reminder. These were flawed men who made bad choices at times. And again, even though not all of them were like that, there was that reminder was very, very strong.
Yeah.
And to the second part of your question, I think something that I wish I had learned sooner was paying attention to more of the human stories within each period in history. So when I think about the Great Death, it wasn't just reading about the plague. It was reading about all of those people who lost everyone to that plague and what it must have been like to think this, to think that the world was ending. Because to them, it wasn't something that they read about. It was something that they were experiencing, and that was their entire world, that mm-hmm. everyone was dying.
Yeah.
When I was doing the episode on Michelangelo, I was really taken aback by his drive to perfection
mm-hmm.
and his experience and what he was going for in his art. I wish I had had that knowledge when I was actually staring at it.
Okay.
Whether it be his paintings or his sculptures, if I had, I got a better understanding of him and learning more about him than I had before. So when we go back there to France again and I see his sculptures, I'm going to be carrying that. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to get more out of that experience than I had in the past. So, John, the rise and fall of government, anacyclosis. Mm-hmm. You talked a lot about the natural progression of society and how it moves. Has there ever been anyone in history who, knowing about anacyclosis, who has tried to create a society that would fit that cycle perfectly? Did they want to influence society in a way, knowing that that was the natural progression?
Well, I think the best example of that are the Founding Fathers, okay, because they understood the flawed nature of man. They set up a system that would be a republic, a federal, constitutional, small-d, democratic republic, but they also built in safeguards designed to protect against an autocracy or the rabid democracy that they feared.
So they took the literal cycle and said, these are the things we want to exclude.
I don't know if they had a copy of the text that deals with anacyclosis and were learning from it, but they certainly understood the cycles that societies go through, having looked at thousands of years of history. And being aware of that, they would have certainly known that monarchies eventually descend into tyrannies, that aristocracies eventually descend into oligarchies, and that democracies and republics eventually fall into ochlocracy. So I don't know if it was a one-to-one ratio, since we know about anacyclosis, thus we're going to write the Constitution.
Okay.
But it was certainly, in their mind, the theory and the historical evidence that is ultimately described in ancient Greece with the concept of anacyclosis, that this could happen and we want to avoid that.
Hmm.
So that was really the first in the modern era instance of someone creating a society. And then it has been mirrored by others. The Constitution of the United States has been mirrored in multiple countries around the world. And the principles found in the Constitution and in the Declaration, certainly by even more, even if you don't have a carbon copy of the American Constitution, most countries in the world today, certainly in the Western world, acknowledge the principles found in the Constitution because they're not unique to the Constitution. They come from nature and nature's God. They are reflected in the belief systems of the three great Western religions, and they are found in the writings of people from all across the West. And so those are going to be, woven into the societies that have evolved over the past 2,000 plus years since the fall of Rome. But in terms of systematizing it and putting it down, I think the Founding Fathers were probably the first.
So Seven Ages of Paris.
Three episodes down. Three episodes. 21 to go.
Yeah, 21 to go. Yeah, no kidding. We talked a lot about the things about Paris that inspired you.
Mm-hmm.
The things that you recall, the things that influenced your study of history. Let's talk about the darkest places in Paris, places where brave people dare not venture.
Oh, I thought you were talking physically dark, and I was going to say the catacombs, because that was certainly the darkest place, all underground.
What would you classify as maybe things in Paris to stay clear of, and how do those things influence Parisian culture as a whole?
It's less about locations. I have not been to every part of Paris.
So you haven't been to the dark place?
Well... No, there have been a couple times when I've been there and it's like, oh man, this is getting a little exciting. It's more about time of day. I would not take students out, and I would be very aware if I was to go out myself, outside of the city center and the really touristy, ritzy areas of Paris, I would not go out after dark.
Okay.
Because unfortunately, like many major cities in the world, like most major cities in the world, Paris does have a serious crime problem, and it's getting worse. The reality is that a lot of Parisians don't leave their homes after dark, or they don't leave their home alone.
Mm-hmm.
So how does that influence Parisian culture? It's almost two different cities. And this is, again, not unique to Paris, and I'm not criticizing Parisians or the Parisian government specifically. By day, Paris is a beautiful city filled with mostly wonderful people. But by night, it is not a place that I would want to visit. We always, when we take students there, we try to be back in our hotels or at least close to our hotels in a restaurant or something like that, pretty closely to dusk.
It's also one of the reasons why we don't stay in Paris. We stayed in Versailles.
That's right. So the trip that I did that you were not able to go on last year, that was the first time we actually stayed in Paris. And that was,
okay.
That's most foremost in my mind. But you're right. In the other trips, we stayed in Versailles.
Right.
Again, I don't want to come off as being unkind, but the reality is a lot of European cities are getting this way. And I honestly saw a lot of American cities.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was, when we were in Munich, it would be 3 years ago, we were actually followed on two different occasions by a group of young guys, and they were speaking in German, and I could obviously understand them. And they were pretty openly describing, because they heard that we were speaking English, so they assume, oh, a bunch of idiot American tourists. They were saying things that I didn't necessarily want, certainly didn't want the women in our group to hear, but even the guys, I was just like, all right, we're going to take a detour. We're going to go look at this beautiful building over here as dusk is falling to give us a chance. And that beautiful building happened to be right by a police station. And yeah, we just kind of hung out there for a little while and then went back to the hotel via a circuitous route.
Right.
Yeah.
So the light and the darkness, the dark ages, I had a, what will sound like a strange question,
okay,
but it's something I've been thinking about for a while, ever since we talked about it. Obviously, the people who lived during that time wouldn't call this period the Dark Ages, but did they sense that something was wrong and different? And did that influence them trying to change that time period, to influence it in a positive way, to get out of that time period?
I don't know whether they actually knew that something was wrong. They certainly knew that something was different. As we talked about, I remember us having this discussion, seeing the Roman ruins and knowing the few stories that had survived the great cataclysm that was the fall of Rome. Seeing all of this and hearing all of this, there was definitely a sense among, at least based on the records that have survived, among the people that, yeah, society has regressed. The world has become smaller. I am no longer part of a, you know, to them, the entire world, a world-spanning empire. I am now part of a citizen of my little town or village, or maybe you lived in a city. And as far as people trying to reclaim some of that glory, you do see that certainly in the military conquests or military attempts, campaigns of Justinian in the Eastern Empire to try and recapture the glory of Rome by conquering Italy, which he is successful in doing, but ends up, it costs him so much money and costs so many lives that it, the empire he builds is a shadow of what Rome was. And then going forward a couple centuries later, you get Charlemagne and you get some great crusaders like Richard the Lionheart, Philip Augustus, and Barbarossa. They are, in a way, trying to recapture some of the military glory of the Roman Empire. And then the other area where you see it is in the intellectual pursuits that are funded and directed and guided by the church. They, of course, want to create a new spiritual idea of Christendom, of a Christian empire, physical empire in the world. And as far as like people in the feudal system, most people in the feudal system, if they had any power, they were enjoying it. They didn't want to change it.
Okay.
And the peasants and the serfs, they didn't have the opportunity, the ability to change it.
So someone who was born in the middle of that time period, who really couldn't reference or didn't have a Roman structure to go to do a comparison, would they hear stories about like the way things used to be?
Possibly.
And, okay, and then equate, okay, well, we're here now and this sucks. So, or...
I don't know. The short answer is I don't know. Because you have the overwhelming presence of the church and of the writings of Augustine and other church fathers, thinking especially of the City of God, they're not necessarily looking to make this world a better place. They're looking to the next world. The whole medieval mindset is accept the suffering of this life in order to increase your glory in the next life. That was one of the reasons why the Dark Ages lasted so long, is there wasn't a huge groundswell of people in society saying, listen, let's make this a better world.
So, John, on a much lighter note,
yes,
the Mont Saint-Michel.
One of my favorite episodes to write. I really enjoyed that one.
I enjoyed hearing it, for sure. So when people go to this place, which is awesome, what would you suggest people visit in unison? Like, if they're in that area and they want to really understand the context of that structure, is there something that they should do first? Is there something that they should do after? Is there a place that they should go to help them put that into context?
I don't think it necessarily has to be in any kind of order, but I would definitely recommend a couple places in Normandy and in that part of northern France. So in no particular order, just I'm not telling you what your travel itinerary should be, but at Mont Saint-Michel, of course, visit the abbey and things like that and tour the entire structure. In Avranches, the church where the abbot who founded the monastery there, I don't remember his name and I don't have the episode in front of me, but it's where he is or where he was interred for a very long time. And then going east, the town of Bayeux has the Bayeux Tapestry, a great period piece from William the Conqueror's time that describes the invasion of England and the conquest of it and kind of the unity that England and France had very briefly. And then from there to Caen, to William the Conqueror's chateau, and then finally to Rouen, which is the historic capital of Normandy. The church there is a monument to religious, political, social, military history. It's beautiful, and it's where Joan of Arc was burnt to the stake, and there are some relics there. But all of those locations illustrate the same history that is preserved in the rock and in the structures of Mont Saint-Michel in different ways. So you've got museums in some cases, you've got churches, and you've got the natural beauty that was Mont Saint-Michel. The movie episode was probably my favorite to discuss with you because we had an epic Star Wars rant on my part, and you got to talk about how awesome Alien was. So I actually have a couple.
I do too, yeah.
Questions on this one. Absolutely. So, all right, so we'll alternate here. My first question, Indiana Jones versus the Terminator. Which franchise in terms of the original?
Indiana Jones.
Indiana Jones.
Oh, yeah.
Better than, okay.
So,
why?
Well, I'm sorry. You started to say
franchise. So not any, basically for Terminator, it's 1 and 2.
Okay.
I'm not counting anything made in the 21st century, so Rise of the Machines, straightforward to whatever the current, Dark Fate. Not discounting all of that, and
Indiana
discounting
Jones.
And discounting Crystal Skull. You would say Indiana Jones is better. Why?
In The Last Crusade, there are personal scenes showing the dialogue between father and son. I love the scene on the blimp when they're sitting across from each other having a drink, and they get into kind of an argument. Mm-hmm. And his dad is like, well, we're here now.
Let's talk.
Let's talk. He's like, I don't know what to say. Then what are you complaining about? We got work to do. You know, it's such a cool exchange. And I actually love the part where Indy swings into the window for the first time to save his dad. Mm-hmm. And he's like, Junior. It is you, Junior. It's like,
and he immediately snaps to, yes, sir.
Well, he's like, don't call me that, please. It is you, Junior. Yeah. It's so genuine, and you just feel like there's a connection there. The first film was adventure, pure fun.
Oh yeah,
it's just so epic.
I like the second one.
No one likes the second one, but the third one just wrapped it all up. It was just so good. It was so perfect.
So and did we need a fourth one? And do we need the fifth one that is currently in development by the same people who destroyed Star Wars?
Well, I think that the fourth one could have been good
if it hadn't been aliens.
Well, if the characters had been more played out.
Yeah.
We didn't need somebody swinging from vines
and
to catch up. to catch up to the convoy of vehicles, somehow timing it exactly right. And Indy somehow became a superhero, where he would punch a guy in the face and he'd get like knocked out.
And he survived a nuclear explosion inside a fridge.
It was lead lined. It was
okay.
And
he survived it rolling across the desert.
It just became, it turned into something else. It kind of turned into what Die Hard did. The first film, John McClane is a normal cop, normal guy, caught in a bad spot.
And the fifth one, he's taking down helicopters barehanded.
I mean, in the first one, he's doing logical things that a lot of people said, yeah, that makes sense. And then, to your point, he's taking down helicopters with squad cars.
Yeah.
Somehow, it just turned into, he's like this superhero guy. Mm-hmm. So, what should people look for in a historical film? And I ask because, what is the limit for taking some artistic freedom to enhance the story if it's boring, mm-hmm. to the point where it's no longer history?
Well, it depends. If you are going to this movie, or these days streaming this movie, for pure entertainment, do what you want. I don't have any kind of, you know, criteria for what is an entertaining movie. I don't have the standing or the right to tell you what you can and can't like, with the exception of Star Wars, which was ruined because they put, you know, ideology before a good story. So I'm allowed to tell you that you're wrong to like the new Star Wars movies. No, even that. People are welcome to like that. I will question your sanity, but hey, do your thing. When it comes to if teachers or if parents or if really anyone just wants to learn from history by watching a movie, I have pretty strict criteria because any deviation beyond like film is a different medium than books, then and certainly it's a it's a different way to capture real life. So if you're going to have to like summarize events or create composite characters, okay, I can't complain about that. But if the filmmaker is trying to preach at you, if they're trying to say, all right, this is how I interpret the events of history, and they don't make it clear that this is an interpretation, if they try and say that this is how it happened, that is, in my opinion, problematic.
Okay.
So an example would be a comparison between Braveheart and The Passion of the Christ. So The Passion of the Christ was these are two Mel Gibson movies. Passion of the Christ was controversial at the time, has not continued to be. It is a, in the minds of the director, a faithful retelling of the last 24 hours, basically, of Jesus' life. There's not an ideology. People said, oh, it's anti-Semitic. No, it was not anti-Semitic. It was Gibson's interpretation. Is it what actually happened? Who knows? But it's pretty faithful to what the Bible says. That's, in my opinion, a good historical movie. Braveheart is not, because Gibson and his screenwriter, intentionally or not, they sabotaged the, quote, historical value of Braveheart in, like, the opening four or five lines, when the narrator, who turns out to be Robert the Bruce, says, historians in England will say I am a liar, but, and then he describes William Wallace. Well, okay, that shows that you're presenting opinion as fact. And so when people watch Braveheart to understand William Wallace's rebellion and Scottish history from the, I think it was the late 11, early 1200s, might get the timeline wrong, or might get the dates wrong. If they watch it to say, and then say, okay, this is what actually happened, this is history. No, that's bad history. That's only one side. It's the same with politics, it's the same with science, the same with really anything where there are opinions involved. Good history, like good science and good politics and good religion and things like that, they present the whole picture. They don't try and focus in on one specific interpretation, one specific viewpoint.
Hmm.
I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, absolutely.
There. Yeah. If you'll permit me, I hope you will, and even if you won't, I control the computer over here, so you have to. During the vaccine episode, we referenced my grandmother, Betty, who suffered from polio, and I talked about that. And I just want to note, for those who've heard that episode, she passed away in January, and one of my abiding memories of her, a tireless volunteer at St. Vincent de Paul, which is a wonderful charity. If any of you are looking for charities to support, St. Vincent de Paul is fantastic. Mm-hmm. And she would knit baby caps and booties and send them to hospitals. And we sent them, man. her kids and her grandkids, myself included, we would take bags of these things to hospitals all around the world. I dropped them at hospital doors in France, in Germany, in the UK, in Austria and in Switzerland. And I know I have two cousins who are flight attendants, and they've gone all around the world. But one of my abiding lessons that I learned from her is just a level of kindness that I think is sorely missing in this world today, regardless of politics, regardless of COVID or anything else. When we had her online memorial, many, many people mentioned the fact that regardless of who you were, regardless of how long she had known you, she would go into Walmart before COVID and she would just give hugs to anyone who wanted them.
Mm.
And just a lesson from her. This has nothing to do with vaccines, but I'm gonna use my platform
to
just advocate a little more kindness. And I speak as someone who could definitely be a little more kind at times.
Like when the mic turns off, Joel, he's awful. He's a terrible person.
But for all of us to remember that kindness is one of the defining traits that makes us human, and my grandmother Betty was a stellar example of that, and a daily reminder to me to be a kinder person in my daily life.
I think that there is a level of kindness in these mm-hmm. uncertain times that we can suspend our own beliefs and our own discomfort for the benefit of someone else.
Mm-hmm.
So if there is someone that would benefit from you doing something uncomfortable, like wear a mask, which it's not really uncomfortable. It's just turned into this unnecessarily political thing and should never have been, ever.
I agree.
Just wear one. I mean, just for that person, in order to serve them, to be kind to them, to lower their anxiety in that moment, so you can have that exchange and maybe build a relationship that would allow you to have those deeper conversations about why that anxiety exists. That, to me, is more important than the moment of political statement where you're like, no, I refuse to do this, because, you know, it's it's so much more important to have that connection.
Every time I go into a store, there's a part of me that's like, I want to just, even if, regardless of what, whether or not here in Indiana, if they have a sign up, then you have to wear the mask. And if they don't, then you don't have to. But I fight that, like, oh, I want to just rip the mask off and I don't care. Yeah. Because for someone with a beard of my length, it is a little bit uncomfortable. I'm not complaining. They're obviously first world problems right there. But yeah. I try to remind myself, and I'm not always the best at it. In fact, I rarely am in terms of reminding myself, be kind, you know, be like Grandma Betty. But yeah, I just want to make a political statement and I can't make it on this podcast. So I make it in my, my mask policy. No, we shouldn't do that.
I was in a larger group today. I won't give any details cause I don't want there to be anyone who might think, oh yeah, he's, you know, it's me. But I was in a group today with people that I normally just see on social media. In my opinion, social media is one of the worst things that's ever happened to civilization. Agreed. So I've seen and read posts that I don't agree with that have angered me. And these are people I know. This is not strangers that are like making me angry. And I haven't made any comments because there's no point. Mm-hmm. Then I saw them today. I saw a lot of them on all one place. And you know what? I was so excited to see them again because they haven't been in that place for a long time. I went up and I hugged them and we talked and all of that crap, all of that like anger from seeing these infuriating things and these news stories being shared, I didn't care about any of that. I was so excited to see them. How are you? How is your family? How are your kids? Are you doing okay? Those conversations between two people happening where the world doesn't see it. All they see is the bad online. Mm-hmm. And you have that interaction and it's just like all of that, again, crap melted away. And it was just friends talking to friends.
Yeah.
So John,
we talked about all that kindness. Let's talk about the French Revolution.
The collective insanity. Yeah.
This season has been just like up, down, up, down.
It has. It has. It,
really and, wonderful, inspiring episode followed by the end is near.
So collective insanity. I have kind of an odd question, but something that I always think about when I read about this time period. We talked in that episode about what life was like in the cities, how like in Paris mm-hmm. and all that. What was life like for the farmers, those outside of the cities? Because this time period in history was relatively short-lived, had a huge impact, major things happening. Mm-hmm. How did it affect people who weren't part of the masses?
That's a good question. It's very complex. How do I summarize this? So under the Ancien Regime, before the revolution, most people who lived in the countryside were peasants. They weren't necessarily serfs. There was some serfdom still in France. Some peasants were still tied to the land, but the majority weren't. They were farmers. They, you know, grew their crops and sold it at market, and their life was pretty normal. When the first phase of the revolution came and they were told that the new government had been created, they're like, okay, doesn't really affect them.
Right.
Then the Jacobins come in and they change everything. And some peasants, their lives weren't affected depending on their proximity to a city, but a lot of them were either conscripted into the Revolutionary Army because that's when the war began. And so their lives obviously are changed forever. But those who remained in the fields and in the countryside, a lot of them are now organized into revolutionary cadres where, in addition to their work, they had these, quote, revolutionary duties that they had to perform. So they had to work on, like, building roads or rebuilding bridges, things like that. They had to be educated. They would actually have to sit in classrooms, adults, and learn about the revolutionary Jacobin ideas. That goes away when the Directory is formed, and life pretty much goes back to normal. And then under Napoleon, because he reorganizes the political system in a way similar to the Jacobins in terms of just the degree of change, not in terms of the impact on people's lives and with the guillotine and all of that. Napoleon is the only one who really makes the life of the average person in the countryside who was not conscripted to fight in the war a whole lot better. People have more money in their pockets, prices are starting to rise, they're able to get more for their goods. And for a lot of the peasants, serfdom is abolished, that's another benefit, you're no longer tied to the land. For a lot of the peasants, they credited Napoleon with a tremendous rise in their standard of living. So for those who were not conscripted into the war, because that's a whole separate issue, but those who remained on the farms during the period that we're talking about, that was kind of the degree of change.
Okay. So romanticism.
Maybe could you sound a little less enthusiastic about that particular episode? Well,
before I ask you my question, I have a criticism of myself. So I've gone back and listened to myself reading the Sir Henry Newbolt poem that was the intro to that episode.
The Fighting Temeraire.
The Fighting Temeraire. And I sound like a robot who hasn't had a tune-up for about 3 months.
You sound like Mitt Romney.
I sounded terrible, and just an apology to the to our audience.
Like, do you want to read the first stanza again, as you would like to have done?
I dare not embarrass myself. So,
no, it's okay, Joe. We all have. There are times when we record these pretty late, and if memory serves, that was a late one.
It was a late one. It's a great poem, and so yeah. I didn't do it justice. So all that to say, I'm sorry, folks. My apologies on that. So my question for you is, this particular period obviously had an end, but the concept of emotion over reason, has that continued to evolve in its own way?
Yes.
And are we in a form of that still right now?
Yes. Okay. Are. Yeah. I mean, emotionalism and rationalism sometimes don't necessarily correspond. Romanticism is, let's kind of embrace more of the emotional side of the human psyche, which is good. Mm-hmm. So we're not in the romantic period anymore, but we are living in a time that has been very, very heavily influenced by the romantic period. Just like when the French Revolution ended, things didn't reset to back before the revolution, that the ideas and the ideologies unleashed by the revolution echo on today. So, Mr. Crapper, how many poop jokes did you put into that episode? I want to get it on record.
5 to 7.
5 to 7.
Yeah. I tried to include words like straining and other things, just trying to be, again, to lighten it up. And obviously the poem at the beginning, I changed.
Which, did I read that one like a robot?
No, thankfully not. I think it was more like you stopped and started like, wait a minute, wait, this is different. Like, it is different. I say it's different.
Yeah. And what was the funniest joke that you wanted to include but couldn't find a way to include?
So,
or the funniest word?
Being
or
very
comment?
Adolescent here, obviously. So apologies to those people who are maybe offended at that. But
oh, come on, a little bit of bathroom.
Yeah, it has to be. It's like I was really trying to fit the word in interred somehow. But I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it without it being blatantly obvious. This is what Joe Parker was trying to include in this for the purposes of being a 12-year-old. So
that's my question on that podcast.
Is that all you got?
No, that's all I got. It was
history
was a great,
of plumbing.
It was a great episode. It was clear, concise, to the point.
It was really challenging because, yeah, as I said in the podcast, it's just there's so much history, and it's always like little steps here and there. All right, so Civil War 1 and 2, I'm going to combine two questions for you.
Right.
The first one is going to seem relatively boring. I'm always warning you about my questions.
Why
for this.
Warn me about
because
it's just, my goodness.
Anyway, what was the main import and export before, during, and after the Civil War for the United States?
Cotton.
Okay.
Before. Probably corn or wheat. I don't know. During. And after, cotton. Until about the 1880s, when it became manufactured goods.
Okay.
During the Second Industrial Revolution.
The reason why I was asking is we usually think of the Civil War period as all-encompassing, which it was to a certain extent.
Certainly in the United States.
Yeah, but there were other things that were happening in the U.S. at that time. Mm-hmm. So I was trying to think of something like what was a way that we could measure life during that time period besides that conflict.
Yeah.
And so I was thinking, okay, what did we export and import?
Yeah, cotton was it wasn't even close in terms of the amount of, or in terms of the scale of our exports. We exported more cotton, I think, than every other natural resource combined.
Hmm.
Yeah, it was enormous.
And what military strategy was employed in the Civil War that is still taught today or in use? Is there anything?
The doctrine of total war is still very much taught in terms of you don't just target troops on the field, you also target infrastructure and institutions behind the lines to weaken the enemy. in terms of actually being on the battlefield, I mean, flanking, the idea of attacking your enemy from the side, that wasn't unique to the Civil War. That started like back with the Romans, but that is something that still continues to be taught. Of course, now it's with tanks and armored vehicles and things like that. And once we get to drone warfare, I'm not sure how much longer that's gonna continue, but sure, it is still an element of military strategy that is taught today.
Arms of Krupp. I did have a question about how other manufacturers saw the Krupp family during World War II. Mm-hmm. Did American manufacturers see the Krupps as a competitor or as an enemy? And
during the war?
During the war.
Oh, very much an enemy.
Okay.
Yeah.
So before the war, were they just a competitor, before, or was there a sense of this? They're different. They're not just a competitor.
That's a good question. I can't think of anything that I have read that specifically referenced the Krupps. So I can't answer that part except to say that based on my understanding of corporate relations generally between the United States and Germany during the 1930s, before the war, we were actually pretty close. There was a lot of collaboration between American companies and German companies, because in a lot of ways, German companies, even after the Third Reich rose, they were still producing really, really solid products. And so we were buying from them. They were buying from us. The German car companies worked very, very closely with especially Ford. And Henry Ford said some things that I think his children and grandchildren, and maybe he later regretted, because mm-hmm. he said some things about Hitler that were very, very complimentary. So Ford and to a lesser extent General Motors and is it Chrysler, the third one?
Yeah.
Yeah. And Chrysler, they worked with Volkswagen and Porsche and Mercedes and BMW. Okay. So I would imagine that the heavy manufacturing companies had a similar view of Krupp, but I don't know 100% for sure.
Hmm. What separated Krupp from other manufacturers who supplied the weapons of war to the Nazis? Like, why were they more?
It was the level of intimacy, political okay. intimacy that Alfred and Gustav had with
okay.
the high-ranking Nazis.
Okay.
And it's why Gustav was tried at Nuremberg, and Ferdinand Porsche and the heads of BMW and Mercedes were not tried.
Okay.
Yeah. So Churchill, the two-episode opus of this season, where you were able to synthesize, as I said in the first discussion, 90 years of history into 30 minutes. First question, what is a story or a moment in Churchill's life that you desperately wanted to include, but for reasons of time you weren't able to?
Oh, that's a great question. You stumped
And it can
me.
Be a couple if there's more than one.
When Churchill went to meet FDR for the first time in Canada, the ship that he was on, he was usually a patient guy, but for some reason he wanted the ship's captain to go down a specific pathway along the shoreline that the captain said, hey, we're going to encounter some problems. There's going to be some waves that will hit us. It was just not great advice. And Churchill said, just do it. I want you to do that. Mm. And so the ship started to take on water, and someone walked into...
Wait, that was a battleship, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
And it's taking on water?
Yeah, so...
Holy smokes, okay. Here's,
it's just because waves were coming over the sides and all that stuff. So one of Churchill's aides went into his room to check on him, and he's standing with his pants hiked up to his knees because he's ankle deep in water, shaving and singing a song to himself in the mirror. And just like, aren't you panicking? Like, are you uncomfortable?
Yeah.
And Churchill turned. I can't say exactly what he said because it was just perfect. But basically, it's like, this is my fault. I opened my big fat mouth, and this is what I get. And so he's like, I'm just gonna sing my song and shave the way I was planning to.
Really,
this is my comeuppance for being a jerk.
That's hilarious.
Yeah. So it was just like, and then the captain obviously didn't say anything because he was a PM. But he's just like, well, I was wrong, and so here we are.
Okay.
So there's that story. I love that story because it really showed again his humanity, and he was just matter of fact. He was just like, all right. I shouldn't have done this. This is my fault. I did talk about this in the podcast, but just the scene of him on the roof with his binoculars and his cigar and his pea coat and his helmet trying to look for German warplanes.
Did he have a radio? Was he like going to try and like radio it in? Like, there's a plane here?
I don't think so. Okay. I think he was just trying to see them.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I get why, but I also don't know why. You're not going to do anything if you see one. But he just really wanted to see it.
And this was on the roof of 10 Downing Street, right?
It was there and over their shelter as well.
In the annex. Okay. Yeah. All right.
So he would be up there and they would have to physically remove him. He'd just be up smoking a cigar. And I did want to tell the story when he toured the shelters after the first few, the nights of bombings, mm-hmm. where he toured one of the shelters as people were leaving and they were talking to him and he was talking to them and looking at the devastation around them. Cause they went into the shelter not knowing they could feel the bombs. They could hear the bombs, but they didn't know how bad it was until they got out. It was just devastating. Mm-hmm. Everything was gone. And he wept with them. Mm-hmm. He, in his words, he blubbed, but he wept with them openly. And they saw that. And there is a recorded quote from somebody in the crowd saying, "Look, he's crying. He actually cares about us." And so I really wanted to include that. And there's actually a scene in the Churchill film that has where he's actually
Darkest
on a
Hour,
yeah, right? Yeah, yeah, and he's actually on a subway, I think, or
yeah, he's yeah. on the underground.
Something similar happens. It's kind of this. It's a similar scene. It's not that scene, mm-hmm. but that's accurate. I mean, that spoke to the people, and his tears were sincere.
And he was one of the first, or probably the first, prime minister who had that kind of emotional connection to the everyday people. Because before that, most of the prime ministers, I mean, Ramsay MacDonald might be the exception, were members of Britain's elite, mm-hmm. and would thus really not have any interest in the commoners.
Yeah.
So, yeah, another bit of there was difference between Churchill and his predecessor. As far as Churchill's in the discussion, we talked about his relationship with his wife and a little bit about his kids. But can you tell us a little bit more about his relationship with his, especially his son, but then also with his daughters? Because we didn't really get a chance to get too deep into that in the in that discussion.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting thing. Churchill wrote something that was actually private to his family for a long time, and it recently came out, I think back in 2005 or 6, but he wrote kind of a short story about a dream he had, mm-hmm. About his father. And in this short story, he's painting, and it's at night, and he has a fire in the hearth, and the ghost of his father appears in the chair, and they have a conversation. Mm-hmm. And from his father's perspective, having died well before Churchill became PM, before he did all of his, you know, all these great things he did. So he's going at it from his view of the world at the time of his death, and Churchill's having to fill his father in on everything that's happening. He doesn't ever tell his dad that he's PM. I share all this because it was, again, an illustration of him wanting to win his father's favor. Mm-hmm. His father, in his dream, said, at the beginning of the conversation, I knew you would never amount to anything. I knew that I'm glad you didn't get into politics because you wouldn't have been successful. Again, from his wow. perspective. Yeah, it was awful. But as the progression, as they keep talking, his dad changes his tune a bit and said, maybe you would have been good in the politics. So there was even, that meant 30 years after his father's passing, there was still that intention to make him proud of his son. And so I say all that because I think that Churchill carried that with him with his own children. He had a different kind of intention with his kids. Now, mm-hmm. again, culture at the time, you still sent them away to schools and yeah. so on, but it was
definitely... And he did have a difficult relationship, especially with his son.
When his son got older, yeah, yeah. Because there is a reality of trying to live in that shadow. It's impossible. But there's also the reality of not feeling like you have to. You don't have to be, you don't have to believe that that's mandatory, that, well, how am I going to go on in life? You know, if dad is so famous and so accomplished, you can still make your own way. It's not, you're not dependent on that. So he had a different intention to be there for his kids, mm-hmm. Which he accomplished to a certain extent. As his son grew older, again, being in that shadow, they drifted apart over time. His son was very rebellious. And enjoyed alcohol a lot and just got into a lot of trouble, said some things he shouldn't, and so on. His daughters were different. His three children reflected different personalities of himself on their own. that taken together, you have Churchill, taken apart, you have each of them.
And hopefully Clementine as well. It was not just,
oh, of course.
They weren't just reflections of their father. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think Clementine obviously made Churchill better as well.
Yeah.
So I think that the relationship was definitely better than the one that he had with his parents, for sure. After a certain time, kids start to make their own choices. You can't ultimately be responsible for those choices.
Yeah. I have commented repeatedly that I dislike what if questions.
Yes.
And that I want to throw my shoe at you.
I'm going to continue to ask them because they're interesting questions if I do say
well,
so
yeah,
myself.
Well, yeah, this ties into something we're going to talk about at the end of this discussion. But I get to ask you a what if. So at Point de Ho, their goal was to destroy those artillery batteries. But it turns out the artillery batteries had been moved. They were inland a couple miles, so the Rangers had to fight their way up and then fight their way inland. Had the batteries been where they were supposed to be, would D-Day have been any different? Would those batteries have made the difference in terms of being able to hit Omaha and Utah Beach?
I don't think so.
No?
No, because you assume that the batteries would still be intact after that bombardment.
Fair point. Okay.
If they hadn't been moved, they would have gotten shrapneled and destroyed.
Shrapneled?
I don't know. Shrapnel would have hit them.
Shakespeare over here is creating new words.
Shards of metal from the bombs exploding around them would have hit specific points in the guns.
Okay.
Although, wait
a minute. Because we've been there. We've been to Lange-sur-Mer. Some of those bunkers are still there. So some of the guns probably would have survived.
Right. Yeah, they would have. But, I mean, would those few guns that did survive change the outcome
of D-Day? They're firing 155 millimeter shells onto the two beaches.
I don't think it would have. Okay. I think there would have been more casualties, for
Certainly,
sure.
Yeah,
but I don't think
the
so.
The outcome was never in doubt?
Yeah, no.
Okay.
So on to a really dark episode.
Yeah, last one of the season.
Yeah, the Nuremberg trials. This ties into...
I actually didn't intend it for it to be that dark.
Yeah.
But it obviously went
dark
that way.
Because of what was revealed.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. This also ties into Krupp. Krupp's crimes during the time period were terrible.
Monstrous.
And yet the person responsible got away with it. There was no lasting punishment for it because an American high commissioner got all the charges dropped.
Yes.
Why and how? Like, why did that happen?
Yeah. So I had to do some reading on this one because I wasn't sure. And those who heard that episode, you know that I failed Joe for, I think, the first time in our whole episode. So I have some notes here. So pardon me as I read from these notes to answer Joe's question. There were several different reasons behind what John McCloy, the American High Commissioner in Germany, did. One of them is tied directly to Nuremberg. We talked last week about how a lot of people thought that this was a case of victor's justice, of the Allies punishing the Germans simply because they had lost the war. That sentiment, as it turns out, was much more widespread in Germany among the everyday people than I realized. Most people thought that what was going on in Nuremberg was unjust. It was a travesty of justice. This should not be happening. Most of them were fine with the senior Nazis being prosecuted for their crimes. But when the subsequent trials started, when the doctor's trial, the SS trial, the Krupp trial, and all of those happened, a lot of people said, okay, that's victor's justice because all you're doing is prosecuting people for, again, following orders, which we've talked about already. So McCloy is very sensitive to public opinion in West Germany, the country that he is helping to run alongside Konrad Adenauer, the head of the German government, the West German government. So that's one reason why. There was a public outcry. All right, enough with the trials. We need to start to normalize relations between West Germany and the rest of the world. And part of that is we need to recognize that yes, these men did terrible things, but we can't be punishing them on and on and on and on. So that was one reason. A second reason is in 1948, the U.S. implemented what was called the Marshall Plan, which was a huge economic investment in not just Germany, but all the countries of Western Europe trying to build up their economies to resist communist infiltration. And Krupp and Krupp AG was a huge part of that. And so McCloy wanted to get the head of Krupp, who knew the business, who knew the workers, back into a position where he could run the company, because it would be more efficient and it would be able to produce more goods and services, thus relieving the United States of some of the financial burden of paying for so much reconstruction in West Germany. So it saves us a little bit of money on our end with the Marshall Plan to have the West Germans using Krupp to do what was needed to build the economy. And then Krupp's colleagues were also part of that general push, saying, listen, we need to, you, John McCloy, and the Americans, you need to restore his property. So again, McCloy is very focused on public policy. And then lastly, McCloy believed that a sense of not forgiveness, but of amnesty, is in keeping with, as he put it, traditional American values. And so he extended the hand of friendship and the amnesty to Krupp and to other senior, not top-level Nazis, but like kind of senior second-level Nazis, in the interests of fighting the Soviet Union. McCloy, more than anything else, was an anti-communist, and he wanted to make sure that West Germany was as strong as possible to resist the tides of communism, and if that meant working with former Nazis, so be it. And we can criticize that, but the United States did the same thing. We had to get to the moon, we had to get into space, and so we used former Nazis who were involved with slave labor and things like that with our space program.
Wow.
So that's the answer to the question that I know has been lingering on the minds of every one of our audience members for the last, I think, 6 weeks.
Yeah, that's not the answer I expected. I was.
Oh, really? What were you expecting?
I don't know what I was expecting, to be honest, because it was, his crimes were so heinous, I couldn't think of a reason why he would be able to get away with it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's just awful.
Yeah.
It's, gosh.
So this is it for season four. It's been a long, fun road. I've enjoyed this. So I want to start off our closing by thanking you for all of your hard work and really for the idea
as well
that was 15 Minute History. We would not be doing this podcast, folks, if Joe hadn't come to me with this crazy idea for the two of us to sit and talk about history. So Joe Parker is the man most seriously, he is the man most responsible for the existence of this podcast.
Well, it wouldn't be possible if not for John's expertise. As it says on our site, he's the authority
in every way.
He's the authority on history here. And, it's been awesome to go through this. I think this has been our longest season so far.
I think so, yeah.
And we've grown just in huge ways, and our audience has grown, and
are awesome. We appreciate you.
You are awesome. So John and I like to ask each other questions about the topics that we cover here. But we also want to hear from you. We want to hear your questions. And it can be about the topics that we covered in season four. It could be about past seasons.
Could be about new movies to review for our next movie episode.
To review.
Yep.
We try and make it easy to contact us, but I just wanted to spell it out a bit. If you go to our website, 15minutehistorypodcast.org/subscribe, there, if you scroll down to mid-page, there's a contact us form. It's really simple. It's three fields. It asks for your name, your email, and then you can type in anything that you're curious about, anything that you want to know. We promise we will not spam you. This
Never.
Is kept confidential. And it just really will help us to understand not only the things you want to hear, but it'll help guide the things that we talk about in the future. So I encourage you to go to that contact us form and ask us a question. You can also go to Facebook Messenger and you can ask us there as well. We're on both all the time. Feel free to ask us at either place. So what we would like to do is collect your questions that you submit to us and form that into a bonus episode over the summer.
Yeah, I think that'll be fun to hear from the audience and to answer some of your questions. And again, doesn't have to be about anything we've covered in any of our four seasons. If you just have general questions about history, you want to know general questions about Joe and I, as long as it's not too personal, you know, we're happy to answer those questions. We're pretty open about who we are as people on this podcast, but we'll be happy to answer any questions that you have. Kind of an ask me anything deal.
Well, on a personal note, I wanted to thank you, our audience, for something that I haven't really talked about at all. We've mentioned it, I think, once. But I do have a speech problem, and sometimes my getting caught on words and not being able to say specific words does carry over into the broadcast. That is something that I do my very best to either edit out or not put on display, because I don't want to interrupt what we're teaching and I don't want to be a distraction. I just wanted to thank you for still joining and tuning in.
Yeah, and we do have more episodes coming for you this summer. We are going to try and put together some bonus episodes, one of them being an Ask Us Anything with questions that you've put together, you, our audience, have sent to us. And then we also are going to do some something that Joe is going to love, and you guys will probably love, and I'm going to have a supply of shoes nearby to throw at Joe.
I will be socially distanced, so it'll be harder to hit.
So we're going to do some what-ifs. In order to satisfy Joe's love of what if questions, we're going to do some bonus episodes where Joe, all he does is ask me, what if this had happened differently? What if this had happened differently? And I'm going to cheat you a little bit using some books. It's a series called What If, edited by Robert Cowley. So if you want to get in on that, and you can find those books, they're really, really good. We're going to do some bonus episodes talking about some of the counterfactuals of history. So those will be coming to you later this summer. One final bit before we sign off here, I want to thank again you, our audience, for being amazing. I also want to extend a personal thanks to Kevin, our sound editor. He is fantastic. The work that he does is what allows you to hear Joe and I as clearly as you do. If you go back to our earlier episodes, the sound quality was not the best, but Kevin puts in a lot of work on each one of these episodes.
He sure does.
We really appreciate him and all of his efforts on the sound engineering part of this podcast. So with that, thank you, our audience, for being a part of 15 Minute History this season. Tell your friends about us, leave reviews wherever you listen to this podcast, spread the word, and follow us on Facebook, and we look forward to hearing from you.
As a follow-up to that, I just want to extend my personal thanks to all of you for tuning in each week. John and I put in a lot of time on this podcast, and we really, really enjoy the work. It is for you all the time, and every episode that we write and speak to and talk about is to teach you and show you and help to illustrate history in a way that you can remember and use in your life.
Season 5, our regular episodes, will resume on Monday, September 13th, 2021. Until then, we'll talk to you this summer. Thank you for being with us each week as we walk in history's footsteps, 15 minutes at a time.